just happened to be in Minnesota visiting my seven brothers and sisters, all of whom are devout Catholics, and a couple of whom think I'm crazy. And I take consolation in reading the Gospel the other day. It was said in the Gospel of Mark that Jesus' brothers and mother had come looking for him to want to take him home. They thought he was out of his mind. They thought he was crazy. So, I think I'm going in the right direction. And, but it's special to me to come back and sit with you together, particularly with Wynn and Mark, with whom I started sitting meditation in 93. I had tried meditation a bit before, but never got anywhere. In 1991, I was attempting to do centering prayer. That's, I think, maybe how I met your sister at St. Olaf. But it was in Pathways that I began sitting with Mark's instruction, and then eventually with the 10-day Buddhist boot camp with Goenka. Those were big breakthroughs for me, very big. I want to make sure as much as possible my comments tonight might be helpful to you in your practice. I mean, I've got a story. My life is, this is my fifth career. And there's a lot of story there, but that story doesn't necessarily serve anybody else's benefit. But I did realize, I retired in 2000, as a stockbroker, and then my partner and I proceeded to form a residential community in Santa Barbara, and that was great. And then our partnership morphed or changed a bit, and so it created there was a separation, and then I began to. Several months into that, I began to look at the possibility, I was feeling relief from being out of the relationship. I was feeling freedom. And then it occurred to me that this may be a possibility of a time of looking at being a monk. And I've always, the seeds of being a monk have been in me from my youth. And it was those seeds of being a monk that initiated my move toward the priesthood. But that was it didn't work well. I didn't experience what I was looking for, and eventually left it after 9 years. There's a bit of a joke in my history. In 97, I was newly engaged to my new partner. And we went to Holland to celebrate our engagement with her family and friends, because she was Dutch. And so we had a great celebration at an old castle. And then she persuaded me to go down to Plum Village for a week. And that was hers and my first experience of Thich Nhat Hanh and the community there. And we stayed with them. They had a lay community that was at the lower hamlet that was all lay people. And that was a breakthrough experience for us, so we came back to the States together to find a way to do that. And we started out trying to do it in Vermont, and then we realized that that's pretty cold in the winter, even though it was going to be close to the community. So we switched to Santa Barbara with friends, and we made it happen. Now, but what's important to me is that I realized I needed a community. I needed to be in a brotherhood, in a brotherhood sisterhood, with more than just a once a week sitting to deal with my habit energies. And my habit energies are, the kind of ones that help me be successful in business. So pushing and striving and being very task oriented and having also a pretty well developed habit of anger. Knowing how and when to release that to make things happen, And so the habit energies of task orientation, being productive, which I got from my father and my mother, it's ancient. And I also have learned to realize that even the habit energy of anger, which I was very quick, you know, short fused, but it made things happen. But that too has something that's been, I think, transmitted to me from some of my ancestors. So it's those two have been big issues for me to work on and to transform. And fortunately, I'm living in a community that is very gentle. That's part of the practice of Thich Nhat Hanh's Zen Buddhism. It's a bit more gentle, has a stronger feminine quality to it than does, I think, Goenka's Vipassana that I began with. Or then I think I've never sat much with, but with Soto Zen. So it has a very gentle characteristic about it. A good strong feminine characteristic. It's a practice that is, it takes people like me who are serious and want to get things done to remember that, no, there's something more important. There's the brotherhood in harmony, and playfulness. Playfulness is a very strong characteristic there, in love. And Thich Nhat Hanh is on record, I think, of, he doesn't like intensity. And, you know, I'm an American, and so I'm the kind of guy that goes to a monastery and says, okay, what's the practice? Let's go and to go at it like we're gonna master this game of tennis or basketball. And just show us the general rules and so on, and we're going to get this down. This practice here in Plum Village that I'm in was described by a monk as, in comparing it with Vipassana, with Goenka, he calls it relaxed continuity. And that means it isn't just being on the cushion, but it's how you walk, and how you prepare breakfast, and how you eat the breakfast, and how you clean the toilets, and how you use the toilets, and so everything's a meditation, and slowing things down. And for me, that's big, because my way of walking was, I learned from my father, is just my mind is already in the office. And I'd be walking already at that point, a 15-minute mile to get there. Like, as Thich Nhat Hanh describes it, it's like walking like you're being chased or being pulled. And, you know, that's our culture. We tend to be a people who walk like somebody's chasing us. And so Plum Village provides me that constant surrounding of brothers and sisters who, you know, it's like, up day, slow down. You know, and of course I'm reminded of that song Simon, the 59th Street Bridge. Slow down, you're going too fast. You've got to make the moment last. So I kind of now and then I'm humming that in Plum Village, and I'm getting lots of chance to walk there because I'm at a lower monastery, which is newer, and about a 300-year-old house or a ranch or, you know, vineyard place, farm. And so I get to walk a lot on up to the upper hamlet. That would be the spot where most of the monks are, and where, like in last month's retreat, Thay comes in, Thich Nhat Hanh comes in and teaches, you know. So it's a nice hike up to there. Learning to walk slowly and mindfully. And that hasn't come real fast for me. It's been I've been a slow learner. And the problem has been for me too, is that in Deer Park, California, we break up the work, you know. Somebody's the shopper, and somebody's in charge of this operation, and I was in charge of landscape, and I was dedicated to changing this Americanized front lawn type of landscape into desert habitation, and so it was natural for the environment. And so when I go for a walk, I keep seeing all these things that needed to be changed. So it's much easier to go to somebody else's place and do a walking meditation. You know, I can walk along the river here, and there may be a lot of things that are not right or broken down or whatever need to be cleaned up. I can walk by there easily, but when I'm on my own territory, I kept getting caught, you know. And once in Vermont, I was working on the orchard, and for walking meditation, And somebody had to say, Adrian, this is walking meditation. I was going over to repair a tree. That's my habit energy. It's just boom. It's a habit energy of also the bell rings. That means in 15 minutes we're to be at a talk. And this tendency to, at 15 minutes, okay, I'll take care of this. And on the way, I'll take care of that. And that. And look, you might look at your own habit energies as to how much when you're deciding that you're going to a certain event or place and to be there like at 10 o'clock, that how many little things pop up in the mind that says, I could take care of this and I could take care of that, rather than just saying, okay, quietly, breathe, and just walk to the next event and be rested when you get there and not kind of hurrying and hustling. So I'm there in Plum Village because that's the place for me to really make the transformation needed to get at these things. It was nice having a woman in my life, but at this point, that wasn't enough for me to really make the transformations and to be a guy who could really be then present in the relationship, you know, in ways that kept her happy. The old stockbroker would come home and still be at the office, and those habits don't go away very easily. Now, though, 4 years later, I could be a great partner in a relationship. I've learned a few things, but so I feel very lucky at my age, particularly in my fifth career, to be with that community. And in fact, I'm amazed at my experience. My life has been happy in these past 35 years. And but I'm surprised at how happy it has been in this simple life of a monk in Plum Village. Now I'm in France, where life is even more simple than here in the USA. So maybe now, if there might be some questions you have, I'll try to respond to them. Yes.
One that pops right out is the age limit. And I'm thinking of the Indian tradition that stages of life where you become the forest dweller and then the renunciate. I mean, it seems like that culture, the older person who would become.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious why Santa Barbara decided you can't ordain after 50 or whatever.
Well, they made the decision in April of 2004. There was a consensus decision amongst all the monks and nuns in the community, and there was an influence there. That a lot of this had already been happening in Vietnam, but also in the American and European Catholic monastic communities. They had long been establishing age limits. Otherwise, there was a danger that they'd become a geriatric type of institution. Because, you know, once we go over 50, a lot of us, there's a lot more potential costly problems that develop. That's one. But you're right. There's a lot of people in their 50s, for instance, that are just now showing, I mean, would be bringing tremendous talent and fire and real quality into the monastery. And there are a number of them right now around the country and in Plum Village that are trying to work this out. And Thich Nhat Hanh says, well, if the community unanimously says that this woman who is 55 years old is acceptable as a novice in the community, if all the nuns in that community say so, and then like in each hamlet that would be up to, you know, 35, 40 nuns, then it's okay. They will make an exception to the 50-year-old limit. And I think they will. That will be happening. I think that we just ordained a monk, an Italian that's over 50 in Plum Village in February. Maybe he's 53. He'd been around and practicing with the community for 10 years, so he was known he was really known for the quality of his practice and so on. So they'll get beyond that, I think. It'd be more difficult, though, to look at somebody that was my age. I was 68, and they'd known me for 10 years. But also it helped me that even my doctor said I was had the health of somebody that was 20 years younger. And I might have emphasized that with the community when I wrote my letter of application, you know. Now, there's another piece to this. It's a lot easier, by and large, I think. Well, not necessarily. I don't think I've been difficult for the community, but it tends to be easier to take a young man or woman in, you know, even 15, 18, 19, 20, and start to help them develop as a monk. They haven't developed the habit energies that a guy my age had. And so I think that they can more easily flow them into the stream of the community. At least that's been their experience. And this is a community that, in Vietnam, they pick up a lot of young people at the age of 14, 15. And, you know, we in America sit back and say, that's just too young. But it's been working for them. And so I'm living with some monks that, that, you know, went into the monastery at age 14, 15, probably never had a date, you know, and never gone through what we think is required experiences for growing up in America. So time will tell what happens there on that. Thanks for the question. Yes?
I was thinking logistically, might not be very practical for all of us to go to Plum Village because of our different lives and so on. And however, you know, this discussion about age limits kind of prompted in my mind that there may be other solutions, like, for instance, lay ordination. Personally, I'm always feeling the need for community in all sorts of different ways, and it's sort of like sparking in my mind ideas of how could I accomplish that, including also like working with within different generations so that people are not always categorized in different age groups as they tend to be in some ways.
I like what you say, and I agree with you, and we do need, I believe, and I tried once in Santa Barbara to find a way to create an opportunity for lay people to come together and to be an intentional community. And it's not, you know, it's like something I support, and I'm trying to see even a way that they would do that in Plum Village. Turn over a facility to lay people. In Vermont, I think there's some thought of turning over the house that currently houses the nuns in Green Mountain Dharma Center, you know, 5 miles out of Woodstock, and turning that over to lay people, making a lay community. We have a community that's run by lay people in Germany called Intersign. By Carl and Helga, and that's very successful. And those are two people of a very deep practice. They practiced for years and years with Goenka first, and then came to Thich Nhat Hanh in the Plum Village. So right now, I think one of the biggest obstacles to making it happen is financing it. Like, I don't see. It quite happening, and the only way that I see it happening is if, let's say, 8 or 10 lay people would decide they want to do it, and they can bring as much as even sometimes as 60 to 100,000 each, and get the property and set it up. And that's the direction we attempted to go in Santa Barbara. And of course, we picked one of the most expensive areas in the world to do it. And that and we thought we'd do it for just 4 years and then 5 years, and then move to a larger place where more people could come and less expensive property. But we couldn't quite make it work. And the part of the problem was that there were a lot of people that liked the idea, but there were not many people with any kind of economic ability to make an economic contribution. There's a lot of people that just live very simple lives, but they have no what do you call it, equity or no cash reserves. So if I kind of wanted, I suggested that Deer Park, California, take 8 acres on the far end, near attached to the city, and cut it off, and let lay people come in and build houses on it, and do some cluster homes. You know, something that wouldn't be horribly expensive. But I don't see it going anywhere. And the other piece is for lay men and women who want to go deepen, really deepen their practice, go and live with the monks or the nuns, and there's some ways in which they're working it out. That some people are in very long stays, you know, not just 3 months, but a year, that's currently the best option, as I see it, for people. And you all should at least go to Plum Village for 3 weeks. I have my brothers and sisters who came to visit me. You know, they'd spend 3 days or 4 days. That's not enough. It takes about 3 or 4 days to get your heads out of Minneapolis or wherever you've been, and then to relax into it, and then to really experience the life of the community. Like you were there for 3 weeks, I think, the two of you at one time, and that's like the minimum, I think, to really get a feel of the flow, the stream of the community. And, okay. Yes?
I'm curious to if you have regrets from your many other careers that you've left, and relationships, and how that's been for you.
I'm amazed at how I have no regrets. I left the priesthood, and I never once regretted, you know, not being there to hear confessions or to give sermons. But I did regret this, and it took me 10 years later, because I was so determined and so out of touch with my feelings, I think, when I left. 10 years later, I realized that it was the death of a dream. And I had a deep dream and a vision of what I was going to be and do as a priest, and that died. That died before I left. It died with what I was experiencing from the hierarchy and the abuse of authority in the church, and so I had a lot of reasons. But it took me 10 years to realize that I had a lot of grief that I hadn't mourned, and then I proceeded to do that. What helped provoke that? I was going through a divorce, and so there was a combination of grief at the time. But each step of the way, I've made decisions, and I've made a lot of them, and endings. I think I, for the most part, have been more in touch with my feelings and more complete, and. Well, there were times when I began to look at a failed relationship, like a marriage, as again a defeat. But then now I look back, and so did my partner at that time, with whom I have a great relationship. Look back on it as just a great learning experience for both of us. Yeah, I live in real gratitude for having gone through these experiences that, in a way, were so painful. But now it's like I look back, and these are part of getting to where I am now, and I didn't foresee that. And the partner who introduced me to Plum Village on our engagement trip to Europe. At first, had changed her mind. See, what happened is that we were kind of working on things. I went to Plum Village, and in Plum Village, I got real clear. Yeah, I'm going to pack it in with this gang. These brothers do live the teaching of Thich Nhat Hanh. I was kind of testing that. And so I came back to California at the end of January to say, this is it, and to meet with her and my daughter and my Minnesota Catholic brothers and sisters, and Bob Geitz. And she had changed her mind, and during the time that I was at Plum Village doing the retreat, she thought we had a very good thing going and wanted to resume the relationship. So I got back to what was then a grieving widow, because I was very clear, and she was in deep sorrow. But we worked through that, and then she continued to work on, do her work, and now today, this is actually 4 years later, we're in communication, and she's just doing wonderfully, and is a very happy woman, and we have a communication that's very deep. So everything has turned out in a way very well. We both just kept opening up, and things have worked out serendipitously. I think in my life, younger years, I did have a tendency to live in regret, but that hasn't been in the past 10 years. I've been able to let the past let go. Was it? Yes.
What's the best and the worst part of being a monk?
Well, sometimes it's robe and the inconvenience of handling a robe. I'm not, I just not in love with dresses. At least I'm men. It's kind of a minor little thing, and I have to keep reminding myself that. Because when I was a priest, we were so quick to get out of the cassocks and out of the robes. And of course, then we wanted to go incognito, going out and so on. But this keeps me honest about who I am and what I'm up to in the world. And so, I walk down the street, and aren't many of these walking down the street of Minneapolis or Little Grand Meadow, Minnesota, where I come from. Weird. Shaved head and the whole works. The shaved head, that's... I see you guys, but the shaved head is supposed to be a sign to the women in the world that I'm no longer available for marriage. Did you know that? That's for us Buddhist monks, and nuns, that's what the shaved head is about. No longer available for marriage. Look elsewhere. Yeah, see, I notice it. Yeah, you better keep that cap on. And so the robe even, which has kind of been an irritation to me, and I kind of hurry up and it always seems, there's a gatha, a little poem that we say, putting on this robe of a monk, my heart is at ease. I live a life of freedom, bringing joy to the world. And of course that has to be, looking at that. Now I do have a real sense, as I'm at the monastery and people are coming in, and interacting with the lay people, and I do that real easily. I really have that sense that of bringing joy and happiness to people and to my fellow monks. What's the most difficult thing you ask, like being a monk?
And most joyful, I think.
The most joyful is the sense of camaraderie and playfulness and brotherhood that I was looking for in the priesthood and never got. That's one of the most joyful. Another that's most joyful is that I come together with, at a monastery, maybe this many monks and nuns that are sitting together in the morning. Sometimes, like in California, in the mornings, monks and nuns meditated together in the same meditation hall. Plum Village were separate. I'm aware that when you come together, we have the intention. We all have a deep intention to go all the way for what's available in life, in terms of wisdom and enlightenment. I can look around and I know that with all my brothers and sisters, I see each one of them are just committed all the way to full all out celebration of life as a monastic. And we have an understanding that there's an energy when you come together like that. It's a collective energy in sitting. And that's what's very important about sitting together versus sitting alone at home. This energy is very supportive. But what we do, and Thich Nhat Hanh has helped us do, and it's something I recovered from my Catholic background, the chant. So whenever we start sitting, one of us does an introductory chant. And we had a Muslim opera singer come and visit us for a couple months, who also did some work with some of us on teaching us about chanting. And it's like when I chant, and I do the leading chant, I do it with the awareness that it's my job to send energy to all the monks and nuns, so that we all get clear as to what we're up to. And it's a quantum physics reality of connecting and sending energy, so that we kind of all get into phase, and then for that next half hour, 45 minutes, we're cooking, you know, so to speak. And it's really noticeable that's a real joy for me in the monastery, that when we have that. And it's a disappointment when I find that there's some days, like after big retreats and that, we go into lazy period. And monks, we know how to get lazy. And a lot of guys just don't show up then for the morning sit. It's okay. But I know the difference, that when we're five guys doing it versus 25, you know, and that energy. That's one of the joyful parts of it. One of the difficult things, again, is for me to deal with my habit energy. So I may tangle with a monk, and I get impatient, and my old habit energies come up, I'm learning how to stop and check my anger, and to try to breathe and calm it down, and recognize that monk that I'm irritated at, he's doing his best. And he's got his own suffering, and there is a suffering that I'm kind of intolerant of, and that's men who won't take a risk, or who are always hesitant and cautious, and you know, that kind of thing when we're dealing with things. But for me, it's turning out to be one of the it's difficult, but it's most also satisfying for me to bit by bit, and that's it, bit by bit, change these old habits. Some of which made me kind of a tough taskmaster when I was an employer with a team of people on a project. And now I understand why a couple of the guys complained that I was, you know, it's taken this long. So it's bit by bit by bit, you know, and it's like, as Thay says, you know, bit by bit, we're part-time Buddhas. You know, and so we show up now and then, and the Buddha shows up. Transformation shows up, and it's just bit by bit. And that, to me, is also the justification for guys like me to be in a monastery where it's day after day after day, hour after hour. You just kind of keep working at it. There's no, you know, I'd like to be at one of those mystics that just has a huge breakthrough, and they arrive, and they're real clear about everything, but I'm one of these guys just trudging along bit by bit, and so I don't know if that kind of answers the question a bit. Yes?
I have another question.
Okay.
How did Buddhism inform your being a stockbroker? So if you were to be a stockbroker, you know, if you're a stockbroker, how would Buddhism now, in hindsight, affect your being a stockbroker?
Well, even in 1995, I used to have on my screen, and it kept going across, a Nietzsche. This too will pass. I got that from Goenka. The market was going like this, so everything is impermanent. I was able to pick up some of that even then, because, you know, I was dealing with people who were very attached to their wealth and kind of control it, and I was a fairly, I was pretty much of a risk-taking kind of monk. Not monk, stockbroker. They're trying to, you know, we have what we call fine manners in the monastery. That's a whole set of about 30 30 points that you call fine manners as a monk. And the community's working with me to apply fine manners so that I'm less of a risk taker on some things as a monk. But as a stockbroker, it's like becoming, you know, increasingly aware of... well, in fact, I even used to have on my wall in the office the fourth mindfulness training about aware of the suffering that's caused by speech, wrong speech, and therefore the invitation to speak in a way that inspires hope and confidence, and to always move to quickly resolve conflicts. It's full of it in the stock market. The problem as a stockbroker is to stop multitasking. So you got the computer, you got the telephone, you got the speaker here, and what's coming down on Wall Street, and you got somebody on the line, and you're trying to make a transaction, but you're doing four things at once. And then you tend to stop and read the Wall Street Journal during lunch. So what you're doing is eating the stock market for lunch. And I got a little smarter on that, and I'd go find an empty office on the 33rd floor of the IDS Tower, and look out over the river, and just kind of quietly eat a sandwich mindfully, and appreciate that, gee, this particular lunch was an eating meditation. So as a stockbroker, I did some of those things that, and learning to make the old, you know, there was always the walk down the hall to the lavatory, you know, you're hustling, you got to get down there because you're already planning the next phone call. But to go down there and have a walking meditation for the 30 or 40 steps there. And as Thich Nhat Hanh talks about, and also there's peeing meditation. Well, you know, and you watch how often when you go to the lavatory, your mind is elsewhere on what you're going to get back to. When this practice of Plum Village is, no, you keep your mind right here. And don't be reading, don't be having a cup of coffee in the jhan, you know. It's like you pay attention to what's going on, you know. And above all, you might show gratitude for having a body that really functions well. You know, a lot of people don't have that. Yes?
I was wondering about, you talked about you have an energy and needing to be a monk to have a daily reminder of your heaven energy. What about many of us that don't have that daily opportunity? What is your thought on us being
able to do something with our heaven energy? Like a suggestion? Mm-hmm. Well, my inclinations back then was high priority is to have a partner, a lover, who also practiced with me. If you got that, that's a real boon. That's a real asset. And to gather here. I would probably, if I was in town, I'd be also getting Mark on the phone or for a cup of coffee for a little extra time. And for, as I tell the people in the Plum Village practice, whether there's a lot of sanghas in LA and even in Minneapolis here or New York City or wherever, the weekly sitting is not enough. The weekly Dharma sharing is not enough. And therefore, I pick somebody or two people that would be my co-mentor or that would agree that during the week, let's touch bases and talk about what's coming down or how it's going. In terms of, let's say, this week, my aspiration is I'm going to stop this business of cramming in extra things before an event. And I'm just going to try to simplify and slow down. And then to be able to touch bases and during the week or at the end of a week and say, how'd we do? And you know, get a little feedback. I even did this once on a three-week retreat with a practitioner so that we partnered up and then we'd look at these particular aspirations and then maybe another one was mindful speech, or another one for me would be monitoring my tendency to get irritated and to act out of irritation. But to take these things one at a time, and then I'll be able to have somebody who's in my corner that I can call and just talk about it a bit. Somebody who also knows how to not only listen to me, but to water my flowers, and to remind me that, gee, amidst all this, maybe there's some things that also keep in mind what went well, and then to provide, you know, maybe some suggestions as to. But you know, even as a stockbroker, we had such an arrangement. You know, you'd say, start out Monday this week. I'm gonna do, you know, $1 million of business in this kind of stock, and then to check in with your buddy at the end of the week, how'd I do? Okay, you know, it's like making a promise, and that you don't get guilty about if you don't make it. And that's this kind of thing, is that to be able to make a promise is to what particular aspect of my practice am I going to try to maybe focus on and then get that help on? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And sometimes you need more than one person. You know, even in the monastery, we each have a mentor. And I'm also, Pai also says, and if you need, it's okay to have an underground mentor, was not one of the official mentors, and I do that sort of thing too. Another question?
What's your daily life like?
I'm up at, we get up at 5, there's a bell. We have a lot of bells. And bells are good for me because Thai teaches, the bell is the voice of the Buddha. Or, if you want to be very Catholic about it, the bell is the voice of Christ within. So when the bell rings, stop all thinking, come home to myself, and look at what's going on. So our practice is to be up at 5 and to start sitting at 5:45. So I can make sure I'm a little more awake. I get up maybe 4:30, 1:45, and have tea. And the good Chinese tea that has caffeine in it, you know? Green tea. But a cup of that quietly, and just to sit there, and that's like a meditation, a tea meditation, and just to drink the tea and listen to the birds, and then over to meditation at 5:45. At 6:30, normally we'll have then what we call the touching of the earth, and that's a brief meditation. Thay's book on touching the earth is it's a rich piece. Then, and touching the earth means that we bring something to mind, and then we go on prostration, but it's kind of an infant, what do you call it, pose on the floor, face on the ground, to meditate on it for a while. And then after that, sometimes 15, 20 minutes, half hour, I'll go out and do the Qigong stick exercise. And that's a wonderful, takes about 20, 25 minutes to do. Very good. And you do it breathing with it. And then breakfast. And by that time, you got a real appetite. And so you have breakfast, which is usually at my house, made by two guys. And then we circle up and sit together in a room. It's about this size, you know. And have our breakfast. The first part is silent. And then and then after breakfast, somebody's on for a wash-up. And then on a non-retreat time, there may be something around 9 o'clock, we call it mindful working or working meditation, and that might be out in the garden or out cleaning up one of the recently used guest quarters, or it might mean remodeling some things. So it'll be a hands-on labor type of thing for a couple of hours, then a break, and then there's walking meditation at 11 o'clock. And so then the community will take a walk across the countryside, through the woods, and that lasts about 45 minutes to an hour, just simply walking quietly, and then back for lunch at 12:30, 1:30 nap time. 3 o'clock will be a meeting, and we have, as part of our practice, we have a couple of very important kinds of meetings. One is called Beginning Anew, and that's where we come together. And that's the time to, if you notice something in your brothers that's good, you take the flower and you have the floor, and what you do is you water that person's flowers. A monk who maybe stepped up and really did something well, it's a compliment, but it's an honest kind of complimenting. You know, the family I grew up in Minnesota, it was a good German-Irish Catholic family, And there wasn't a whole lot of complimenting, because I think there was a fear that you'd get the big head. You know, and that was a no-no in our family. You don't get the big head. And so there wasn't a lot of that. So for me in the monastery, this is neat. That to be able to look at somebody and to come in front of your brothers or sisters, to compliment them, let them know straight that something good was done. Then the next piece is, and if you have something you regret, you didn't show up for a meeting or you didn't prepare what you were supposed to, and it was a letdown for the community, or you offended somebody, you express that regret. And the third thing is, if you've got a conflict that you haven't been able to resolve outside the circle of the community, then you may bring it up to the brothers, and you might say that such a brother and you tangled and you had a big argument and you couldn't agree to how something, and so you're still at loggerheads, and he refuses to settle it with me as I understand it, and so that's my problem, and here I share it with you, brothers, and the guy that I'm complaining about doesn't get to speak until the next day. Or if I'm the one complained about, I don't get to speak until the next day. So this is what we call the beginning anew. And it's a very good practice. And it's very good for families. We did it at the Santa Barbara Lay Center, and it was so wonderful seeing this 12-year-old girl water her mother's flowers. You know, it was like, and it was, and also when this happens, it's the rest of us say, oh yeah, what this kid is saying is true about this mother. And it's like help to raise our own, it helps to raise your own understanding and appreciation of the others. You may not be the one that's identified what's to be the flower to be watered beforehand, but it's an eye-opener. So we strongly recommend it, and in part of our retreats, it's being taught to couples. It's called Beginning Anew. The other thing we do in the retreat, in our training and our practice, is on another day we have a happiness meeting. And that's just to get together and we kind of check in with each other as how things are going and what's going well. And that would be an opportunity then, if I don't like something that's going on or I got a suggestion for improvement the way the monastery is being run, I bring it in there. And so it gives us a chance to kind of keep up to date on how we're doing as a collective. As a collective operation. Then comes 5 o'clock sitting again, and on at least Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, it's a total relaxation at 5 o'clock. And that's another one of our good practices, total relaxation. And then the evening is free. Now, I'm going back up. Monday is lazy day. On Sunday, we're pretty much out there dealing with people. There's a talk, and lots of people come in. And we collect all the monasteries, come together for the day of mindfulness. And so that's a full day until 4:30. But Monday's lazy day. And that's the day of to practice non-practice. The community is real clear about watching out for people who get too attached to the form. You know, it's like getting fixated on that there's a right way to do all this. And you always got to sit and you always got to do this. And so the practice of non-practice, we do that on a lazy day. That kind of answered the question. Yeah.
We just have a few minutes left. I was wondering, Brother Papte, if you could do a little chant for us in the evening. Would you be willing to do that? I know he has a little bit of a sinus cold going on, but if you haven't heard the Thai Thich Nhat Hanh community chanting, there's a nice CD you can order from Parallax Press that has it, and it's very beautiful. They kind of modeled it after some of the Gregorian chanting.
Yeah, Thay told the monk, an American monk, Thay Phat Bien, he wanted to see some chants developed. He didn't want any marches. No marches. And he suggested that it be music that Westerners, this isn't for Asians, this is music for Westerners. And so he encouraged them to check into Gregorian chant. So a lot of that has been influenced that way. I'll try to do what we do in the morning chant, okay?
Thank you.
we do a lot of sounding of the bell, inviting of the bell. Now and then I slip and ask a brother, say, would you ring the bell for me? And that's it. We don't ring the bell. But that's my own, you know, lack of mindfulness. Of that. We invite the bell. And so there's a gatha that we say before doing the bell, and it goes like this. Body, mind, and spirit in perfect oneness, I send my heart out with the sound of this bell, that hearers may awaken from their forgetfulness and transcend the path of anxiety and sorrow. Responds. Namo Shakyamunaye Buddhaya. The sitting with that. And yeah, that gives you an idea how we start the day at 5:45.
So you can do what Gwen and I do, at least at times, as we have our alarm set to that CD and it plays that. That's what wakes us up in the morning sometimes.
Ah.
It's very nice.
There is one more thing about chanting, is that we have a big bell. About that big around, about as high as the ceiling, and so the inviter is like that, and go like that. And we go out and chant to it, and I really love that practice, particularly on days that we don't sit. And and there's some wonderful chants about it, but and they're all translations of the Vietnamese chants, and I have them in English. And but in there, I also fit in an old chant that's 1,000 years old. And it's an old Gregorian chant to the great Catholic Bodhisattva, the great Catholic Kuan Yin called Our Mother of Compassion, to the Mother of Mary, Salve Regina. So I think we're the only Buddhist monastery, when I'm at it, in the world, that one of the chants in the half hour of chanting, you'll hear the Salve Regina. Thank you so much,
Brother Phapsay, for coming. So if you'd like to support Brother Phapsay, when we have a guest speaker like Brother Phapsay, we offer 2/3 of the donations that come in as a gift for their livelihood. So you can keep that in mind if you'd like to leave a gift tonight. And we do have a day-long retreat this coming Saturday, if anybody's interested. And we also have another guest speaker Thursday. I think it's August 30th, so a week from this coming Thursday, Rebecca Bradshaw will be in town. She's one of the teachers at IMS, and she's going to be, the title of her talk is Drive Through That Town, an Unconventional Look at the Four Noble Truths. And some of you know Mary Jo Meadow, who's spoken here a number of times, a teacher, teaches on. She's actually an ordained Catholic nun and a Buddhist Vipassana teacher. I don't know if you've met Mary Jo Meadow. She was a professor at Mankato State for a number of years. Mm-hmm. But anyway, Rebecca is her daughter of all things. So mother and daughter are both well-known teachers in this country. Anyway, Rebecca will be here that Thursday night. Many of us will be on retreat at Holy Spirit for our Labor Day weekend retreat, so I won't be here, but hopefully a number of people who aren't on the retreat will come and hear Rebecca speak that Thursday evening. And we'll send out an email to everybody on our email mailing list. Any other announcements people have for the community? So thank you again, Brother Phapsay, for coming. Thanks, everyone. Have a good evening.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.